This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Jack O'Neill on the 10th of September 2002 at approximately 8:35. Sir, we were going to continue today's interview by looking at your trip over to Vietnam. And why don't we go ahead and, if you would, describe what it was like. What was the atmosphere like, for instance, on board the aircraft flying? Or did you take aircraft from the East Coast to the West Coast, and then the atmosphere on board the ship going from the West Coast to Vietnam?
That's correct. We flew out of Pope Air Force Base on a chartered commercial, Continental Airlines. I believe he was either a DC-8 or a 707. I can't remember. The mood flying was, I remember being very tired, and, the activity level had been very, very high the last 4 or 5 days, because everybody had been sent home on leave, and getting back together and getting equipment together, and being extremely cramped on the plane. That's probably the most outstanding thing that I remember on the trip to Travis Air Force Base in California was, because we literally had rucksacks, the small type rucksack that sits on the butt, and with the your web belt and your M16 and your helmet, and sitting three across in that configuration was extremely cramped and uncomfortable. I would say the mood was probably one of resignation, not that we would, that we were going to get hurt or die. One of resignation that, well, we're off to war. And there was a few guys that were, were going on their second tours, but they kind of stayed to themselves. I can't remember faces or names, but I just remember the mood was one of, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to California and, again, landed very early morning, still dark, and they put us immediately on buses and basically down to the dock where they fed us in a big building, and we saw the ship, which was the USNS General John J. Pope, and we immediately, that same day we loaded and got into our berths, which were basically hammocks. I think they were three high. We were all, I believe we had told to... Hold one, please, Steve.
Yes, absolutely.
Hold one. Okay.
Go ahead.
So we got on the ship, and, I remember it was a very, very large ship, and there was, as we were told, there was a Navy, what they call scuttle crew on board, with a Merchant Marine crew. And we got on board and got settled in and had to basically chain our duffel bags and M16s in place by our bunks. And that was, that was to be our situation for the next 21 days. We departed, I think, the following day. And that was that was called our actual in-country date once we started the journey, which was April 1st, 1968, and I remember the feeling on the ship was there was just a thousand mixed feelings. Everybody was sticking together, friends were sticking together, and the sights were incredible. I'd never been to California, so you're going out through Oakland, San Francisco Harbor, and we went by Alcatraz and under the Oakland Bay Bridge and under the Golden Gate Bridge. And of course, these are, such American icons, if you will, so much American history there. But let me step back to 1 second. When we got on the bus, there was wire mesh over the doors, over the windows.
Mm-hmm.
I remember someone saying that was because they didn't want the anti-war people throwing stuff into the windows. And that, to me, was a little shocking.
Mm-hmm.
I remember feeling a little stunned about that, as I know a lot of other guys did. And there was a lot of, bravado as far as, forward words about the hippies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe even the term peacenik, I forget what they were called back. You talk of 30 plus years. But, I remember going by Alcatraz, and this may not be important, but it's funny, the things that stand out, and I had to go to the bathroom, and I went down And, of course, there was hundreds of toilets, and they were all occupied. And most of these guys were getting seasick, and we hadn't even got out of the harbor yet. I remember just jokingly saying to myself, this is going to be a long trip. And I ended up, you know, going urinating out of the anchor hole. And it seemed like most of these guys were from the Midwest and hadn't seen anything bigger than a lake. And I remember going underneath the either the Oakland Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate, and there was very, you know, anti-war peace symbols, banners, huge things hung down, and we were warned to be careful of human waste being thrown at us and stuff like that. I still have pictures of going out, and it was, I think it was close to sunset. It was just an absolutely beautiful picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, and I haven't looked at that picture in many, many years, but it's still very vivid in my mind. And you know, when the journey started, and the food was horrible, the sleeping conditions were horrible. You basically had nothing to do. There was, I don't remember any movies. There probably was. I don't remember any form of, quote, entertainment other than that everything was a nickel. You could get a Coca-Cola for a nickel. You could get some Hydrox cookies for a nickel. The old 110 type film you could you could buy very inexpensively. And what I did is I've got a lot of pictures of the ocean, you know, and the experiences vary from absolute boredom to we went through a typhoon, where the bow of the ship is actually going underneath the water, and the props were coming out of the water.
Wow.
You know, the whole ship would shudder, and there was, the areas were roped off, safety lines. And one of our assignments on the ship was to pull guard duty, which was basically very mundane. I think it was just to keep us occupied, and of course you stood there with no weapon or anything else, and it was, nobody could pass into certain areas of the ship because that's where the Navy was and that's where the Merchant Marines quarters were. And, you know, they had very little or nothing to do with us. The captain would make a different announcements during the day of where we were, what our location was in the Pacific Ocean, you know, south of the Hawaiian Islands. The experiences varied. I mean, we got to see a great sight in seeing a blue whale very close to the ship, and the captain announcing that. We were followed by what ended up being a Chinese trawler. And, of course, I put little parentheses around the word trawler because what they were doing is, back in those days, the waste was basically just thrown overboard. I think it was ground up, but it was basically just thrown overboard. And they were actually scooping it up. So we did some kind of, I suppose, obscene things now, but there was a lot of human waste that they were picking up. They didn't realize it. We had one of these P-3 Orions, similar to the one that went down in China. All of a sudden, one day, come out of the fog on two engines. I mean, it was tracking us just to, you know, verify our position and who we were. And it was flying on two engines. And I was like, wow, I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And I'd seen those aircraft down at Weymouth Naval Air Station, where my uncle had retired from as the chief enlisted guy down there many years ago. And, you know, the sub chasers and stuff like that. And it was just, that was SOP, was for them to fly on two engines to save fuel. But I remember them going very low, you know, out of the, I would say probably out of the north, heading south as we were heading west. And, you know, just going over the ship. And I think they did a, you know, a 360 and came over again twice. And that's, I'm not really sure about that. We really didn't see much after that until the day before we would hit Subic Bay in the Philippines. They were telling us to conserve water. We were running out of drinking water, and we couldn't bathe, and only flush the toilets when you had a bowel movement, so things like that. You know, it's just funny the things that stick out to you. And then later on that afternoon, I would say around 3 o'clock, there was an announcement over the public address system if there was any people on board that had insulin. And there was a guy not from our unit. I believe he was from one of the helicopter unit that was on board. And I think they were a helicopter maintenance unit. I'm not really sure. And he had gone into diabetic shock.
Oh, no.
And there was no insulin on board. And he basically killed himself because he was just eating too much. I guess his sugar level got too high. I had a form of diabetes when I was in the hospital a couple of years ago. So I know what those insulin shots are like. You know, I hated them, and it was just a part of my recovery with my pancreas going through what it did. But that's not part of the story. But, you know, I know what the insulin does and stuff like that now. And they told us that the Navy was coming out with some insulin by helicopter. I remember standing on the main deck. I believe they call it the poop deck. It was about 60 feet above the water, and you could see off the bow, straight off the bow, these two black dots coming at us. And then out of nowhere, on each side of the ship, were these two F-4 Navy Phantoms, and actually almost right at eye level, maybe even a little bit lower. I mean, these were jet jockeys having a good time, and they came out and they located our position precisely, and they put on a real show. And I vividly remember one of the rear seaters, you know, with the thumbs up, you know, something like out of the movie with Tom Cruise. There, it was just wild, you know. We were all just clapping and fists in the air, and you know, all pumped up. And these guys put on a show for us, breaking the sound barrier, and then a very large naval helicopter came out. I'm not sure what type it was. It was a long-range helicopter, obviously, and they dropped insulin. They hovered over the ship, and that was very interesting to see. I don't know why I didn't get any photographs of it. We may not have been allowed to take any. I'm not sure. And they dropped the insulin about 8 o'clock, and we were informed by a loudspeaker at 10 o'clock that it was too late, that he had died.
Oh, what a shame.
Right. And the next day, as we pulled into Subic Bay, I remember seeing a huge shark just as we came into the entrance of the harbor. And I could smell the tropics for the first time, really, and seeing the beautiful jungle and the flowers and the little Filipino fishing boats and stuff like that. And they were very, you know, pro-American at that time, to my memory. And but we all had to get a gamma globulin shot. Before we could get off the ship. And I know that's for hepatitis, if I'm correct.
Hep A, yeah.
Right. And I remember it was one of the most painful shots I've ever gotten in my life. And it was in the posterior.
Yeah.
And then we were allowed to go on to Subic Bay for, you know, probably 12 hours. And most of us did what anybody would do going into a war situation. We all, you know, went to the local clubs, NCO clubs. We were not allowed down to the town that's outside of Subic Bay. I think it's called Kalangapo or Kalangapo or something like that. And so some guys did. Some guys did. They got in trouble. But, they, you know, what are they going to do? I mean, you're going to Vietnam anyways. I remember myself getting, you know, just waking up on the ship the next day, and we were out to sea. So I got drunk as a skunk, and remember, you know, being in some type of altercation with some guys in the Navy, you know, but never really gotten any real trouble about it. And then, you know, 48 hours later, we were going down the coast of Vietnam at night, and it was very, very, you know, we should have been sleeping, and they were telling us to get ready because we had a lot of stuff ahead of us. It was the real thing now. You know, we were on alert. I believe we were escorted at that time by a couple of destroyers that were nearby us. I don't remember seeing them. It was very late at night. It was black as black could be. Very, 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 very few lights on the ship. But close enough to the shore of Vietnam to, it's like we headed in and then we headed south to Phuong Tau. We were the first ones to get dropped off. And, you know, seeing the tracers and the explosions and the roar of aircraft, and it was like my reflection was, you know, this is the real thing. Ben Rogers, who you met at the reunion, was my, you know, lieutenant at the time, and I think that was when he made his declaration of, you know, I'm going to bring you home alive. And we landed on the beach the next morning, you know, in the, I don't know, LCMs or whatever they are, those little landing craft, because the ship was too big for the harbor, so they docked us at this, like, platform, floating out almost like a big, huge raft out in the middle of the harbor. And they ferried us in by that, and we landed on the beach. It felt like D-Day, but we weren't issued live ammunition until we get up off the beach. And I'm looking around, the guys are sitting there getting suntans and drinking beer, and I didn't know that that was an R&R beach. I didn't even know what R&R was. But it was also right after Tet of 68 and just prior to the May offensive, so there was still a lot of stuff going on. They gave us live ammunition, and someone, you know, gave the order. We were getting ready to get on 2.5-ton trucks and go to the airport to fly to our different areas. And I saw a woman defecating in the street. And I said to Ben, I said, you know, off to the side of the road, actually, and I said to Ben Rogers, I said, you know, why didn't she use the bathroom? And he said, that is her bathroom. And it was the first of many cultural shocks in a very short period of time for me. I mean, I was 18 years old, and it was just a very, you know, they prepared us some, they didn't prepare us for Vietnam. I mean, we had a little bit of Vietnamese language school, but it wasn't really taken too seriously by, I would say, anyone back at Bragg. The teachers were Vietnamese, and I remember them being very beautiful women, you know, and they had the owie eyes on, the traditional woman's dress, but other than that, it was just, you know, the smell was incredible. It was a combination of cordite, diesel fuel, kerosene, rot. Heat was tremendous. And, you know, we locked and loaded, and I remember sitting on the back of the 2.5-ton, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do, and we had gun jeeps, and they took us out to Phung Tau Airport, and it all seems like a blur, and I think it was pretty fast. I think it was orchestrated pretty well, because you got to understand there was a couple thousand people on that ship that had to go to different directions, and the ship went to two or three other ports. I know it. I think I went to Cameron Bay and Da Nang, and let off different people, including people from the fourth group. Of course, at that time was known as the fourth packet. And Ben and I, and I can't say this is the thing that's terrible about the time is I can't remember who else, but we got on a plane, a C-7 Caribou. I'll never forget that. And we call them Shake, Rattle, and Roll. And we flew down to Canto, and we got there, and they took us down to a villa in downtown Canto, and we were immediately told that we weren't supposed to be there. We were supposed to be in Benoit, and then they would fly us up there the next morning. And you know, where I expected to be sleeping on the ground when we got to Vietnam, or in a tent, here I was in this villa with a room, with Air Force-type bunks and big mattresses, and I remember saying, well, this isn't too bad, and you know, food wasn't too bad, and went up on the roof that night to watch a movie, and, you know, there was gunfire, and these guys were sitting there just, like, real relaxed, and I remember watching this Charlie Model gunship working out in a rice paddy, probably, it seemed like it was 100 yards away, it was probably more like a mile away, and probably more of suppressive fire than anything else. I don't remember seeing anything coming up from the ground, but it was an interesting first night and probably not much sleep. And the next morning, they after breakfast, they immediately put us in a 2.5-ton and shipped us out to Canto Airport for the flight to Benoit. And the bridge we had to go over, I hadn't realized that the day before had been blown out during Tet, and it was I suppose it was a Bailey Bridge or whatever those temporary bridges were. And so when they last started to go, the traffic, you know, went one way, and then they'd stop and let the traffic go the other way. I got this incredible smell, and I couldn't identify it. And so I stood up in the truck, and everybody was, you could just feel the tenseness in the air. And there was a bunch of South Vietnamese soldiers, and I looked at their feet, and there was like five or six, maybe seven dead bodies, the first ones I'd ever seen outside of a funeral parlor, mutilated, scrap metal. And what they were, the understanding we got from more experienced people in the truck, that they were either NVA or VC zappers to try to blow that bridge again the night before. And literally, I mean, they looked straight down at them from that truck. And today, that's still a very, very vivid memory, sometimes even intrusive thought. I mean, that was my welcome. I always say that's my welcome to Vietnam.
Now, you arrived in April of 1968, correct?
Pardon me?
You arrived in April of 1968?
Yeah.
When you got there, especially maybe in Canto, and then later when you got back to when you got to Benoit, did the soldiers or the personnel that you interacted with, did they talk much about Tet and what they experienced during Tet?
You know, not that I really remember from the guys in Benoit, because Benoit was pretty much, other than the airbase getting rocketed later, you know, and again, I don't know if this is from a personal account from somebody or, you know, just hearing about it, third party, whatever, you know, the ammo dump at Long Bend taking a tremendous hit of some sort during Tet of 68. But Benoit was fairly quiet. But I learned later on when I went out in the field shortly after my, you know, my arrival at Benoit, the veracity of Tet, in the Providence capitals and stuff like that. And then meeting guys from 4th Group headquarters over the next year, in Saigon, when I would come out of the field and do my reports, and I had to go down to Saigon a couple of times. And, you know, they were, literally trapped in their barracks for a couple of days, and, it was a very horrific attack, but again, my recollections of who, what, and where, and what I know about Tet are a combination of probably mostly reading about it, documentaries, and I'm sure a few personal stories from guys over there, but I can't really remember any details. I wish I could. I wish I could be more.
Well, when you arrived at Benoit, did you receive any kind of briefings? Or?
Well, I think the officers pretty much got the briefings. And they were not prepared for us, even though a advance party had gone from Bragg, had set up pretty much. The 6th Battalion was the thing in Vietnam prior to our arrival. They were in Saigon, and the companies were out in the, which would now become the battalion areas, you know, Benoit, Da Nang, Canto, Nha Trang, Pleiku, where the radio station was, where Mike Merkel got killed during Tet of 68. I just remember being, you know, confused and very frightened, not trusting. See, we were told not to trust any Vietnamese, good, bad, or indifferent, women and children. And to me, I think to all of the new guys, you know, of course they called us FNGs, it was an experience of being right in the midst of these people in downtown Benoit. And in retrospect, realizing that if, you know, the VC or the NVA wanted to take us out, they could have done so at any minute, in a heartbeat. Because very few of the guys had any, you know, field training or training in you know, the use of light weapons other than basic training. They really didn't have anything for me to do for the first couple of months. And they tried to put me, like, in supply, and I didn't know anything about supply. And I questioned that, and I was assertive about it. Ben Rogers couldn't get an assignment out in the field. So I approached, I forget who I approached at the time, but I got assigned to S3 Air Ops. And started flying in the C-47 Goonie Bird, you know, doing the mass leaflet drops and speaker runs in the, you know, in 3-Corps near the Cambodian border, and you know, mostly northwest of Saigon, Michelin area, Phuc Vinh province, things like that, and also getting to ride in the U-10 aircraft, which was side by side. Plane, I believe, was made by Cessna, and that was call sign on that plane. One I remember most of the time was Speak 2-3, and it had a 1,000 watt or 1,500 watt speaker system on right in the side of the plane, and a little leaf would shoot where you actually had to turn around and throw out. You could only take two boxes of leaflets on board because they were so heavy, and you would actually have to turn around in the seat, and it was very, very cramped, and you would have to throw the leaflets out, you know, hand by hand out this tiny chute. And then sit back and play your tape. And, of course, the tape that we played most of the time was The Wandering Soul. I think you heard that discussed at the reunion.
Yes, I did. Why don't you describe it, though, please?
Well, it was... We really like to use it at night. When I went out in the field, we, you know, when I was working with the first Cav, it was a very eerie-sounding tape. And what it was supposed to be was the soul of a North Vietnamese soldier who had been killed in the South and was wandering through the abyss, if you will, trying to get back to his ancestors. And there was some very eerie, you know, Vietnamese funeral music in the background, and this, like, ghostly voice. And we took a lot of fire from that tape. Not every day, but especially out, you know, very close to the Cambodian border, probably even across the border. Lines is, you know, they're not defined, especially at night. And when you're flying, when I was flying in Vietnam at night, especially in the Huey, and we would have to actually mount a speaker system at, you know, at that time, and then you'd throw the leaflets out. You'd sit in the left-hand side of the aircraft and just throw them out as far as you could to your left side, so they wouldn't get in the tail rotor and things like that. And, you know, so you're just circling at like 1,200 feet, 1,500 feet. And, you know, many times, all of a sudden, you'd have these, you know, big orange golf balls coming up at you, and got green, you know, whatever the color of the tracer might be at that time. You know, they didn't know where you were because you were running without any lights, but they came close on a couple of occasions. And, you know, we took some fire, I took some hits, but that was, you know, that was our mission. And you also had what you called your QR, quick reaction mission, where there might be a unit, you know, in a firefight, and you'd actually go in with a chopper and a speaker system and no tape and some safe conduct passes, maybe just one box of leaflets, and you'd circle that area and have your interpreter or one of the NVAs, the actual Chu Hoys, and try to talk people out right during the battle. And many, many times we took fire from the ground, depending on, you know, how many of the enemy was there, because in most cases it was a hit and run thing for the North Vietnamese. You know, they would ambush us, and then we would counterattack with, you know, massive amount of artillery, firepower, air power, ARA, which is a term for aerial rocket artillery, you know, your Cobras, your Charlie model gunships, and they would, you know, retreat into the jungle. And of course we've all heard, and you know, I mean, I've seen it, where they would, you knew that you would kill more than what you would recover, because it was, you know, just many, many drag marks. And then, you know, you'd go out with the field units usually after the battle, sometimes the same day, usually the same day. And, you know, because you knew there was wounded out there, you knew there was injured out there, but they were so adept at concealing their shelters and their ways out. And they always left, in a lot of occasions, they just put, you know, rear guard action, so you'd be going along for maybe, you know, half a kilometer, and, you know, you'd take some fire. And, you know, by the time you eradicated that fire, or he or the couple or whoever was there, you know, they would move up to the next position. You know, you might have a couple of wounded, and unfortunately, obviously, some dead. Get them out, clean up anything that the enemy might be able to use, and march on, or take a break, or stay there for the rest of the day, or even be airlifted out. If in a lot of the cases, especially with the Cav, where they had so many helicopters, caution was pretty much the way they did things. They certainly weren't looking for a fight all the time, but when it looked like, I'm talking about my experiences with pretty much the 3rd Brigade, that when the stuff would hit the fan, initially it could be very overwhelming. There were several times that I felt that this could be it. Several times I saw the enemy at close hand, Most of the time you didn't. Most of the time you would just see smoke coming out of a tree line or coming out of, you know, bushes and stuff like that. And, you know, my job was to, you know, have my M16 in one hand and my speaker in the other and my interpreter to, you know, do his thing. And a lot of times there was controversy because, you know, the grunts wanted a body count. And, you know, I remember feeling very angry many, many times that, you know, I also wanted a body count, but I also knew I had a job to do. And I had to stand up to some, you know, higher-ranking officers and stand my ground. I did that. You know, and we all did that. I mean, all field team members went through the same confusion, if you will. You know, we were out there where the mission was to, you know, bring in live people to get them to, one, turn over to the South Vietnamese government, but also they were an incredible source of intelligence. Whereas the role of the American infantrymen, the American infantry divisions, and everybody else who was combating these people was attrition. It was, and obviously, we know now that that didn't work.
When you went out and started working with the units in the field, how long would you stay out there typically?
It could vary from one day to several days. The longest operation I was on was 39 days.
Did you work with just one unit, or did you work with a number of different units?
I worked with, most of the time that I was out in the field, I spent with the 1st Air Cav, and I'm thinking ahead of myself, and then Ben Rogers and I finally got hooked up, and we went just prior to Teta 69, we worked in right outside the Saigon area, what they called Rocket Alley, with the, I believe it was the 3rd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne, out of Camp Red Ball, if that is, I believe that's correct. I remember the major, the S-5 major, was just a real character. He would take us into Saigon at night. Of course, that was interesting for, you know, I was now 19 years old, and it was just an interesting thing to go through. May even have been 20, I'm just trying to think, doesn't really matter, but I remember going to, you know, old French cafes and things like that, and it was, you know, it was kind of a relief from what I had been through out in the field with the Cav, but, you know, and then the next day we would go out with a unit, or we would go out with our truck and into the villages, and, you know, we'd basically alone. You know, there'd be two or three of us on the team. And, you know, you might be lucky if you got a gun chief to escort you and stuff like that. Sometimes, depending on the village, have you ever heard of the HESS system?
Yes.
Okay.
How did you work with that?
Well, what we did is if it was an A or a B, you know, we pretty much felt secure. We could go out, you know, obviously we were, you know, we were pretty heavily armed. But anything below a B, you know, you wanted to go in there with a little bit more support. If you were down there in the, you know, the D&E echelon, you know, you were in there with at least a rifle company, you know, with air support. And that was, I've got an interesting picture of myself and my, my interpreter, Quan, walking through a bill, and you know, I've got just my boonie cap on and a bandolier, and my 16 in one hand and the speaker in the other, and the picture tells a thousand words, but to me, I remember that village very vividly, and I believe it was a D or an E, and you can see several people in the picture, and they're all women. You know, there was no men in the village, and I just felt like people were looking at me through, you know, through cracks in the little, you know, hooches and grass shacks and things like that. It was pretty frightening. And in that particular day, we were sent in by the company commander of the infantry unit. And, you know, basically, I think he thought we were expendable, you know. And he'd send us in, and nothing happened, you know. They did round up some older men for questioning.
Did you ever use, or did your unit ever use the HESS, the Hamlet Evaluation System designator, as basically the reason to go into a village to conduct a psychological operation?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Basically, without a doubt, yeah. And, but again, this came from, you know, higher echelons, from your, you know, your S1 or your G1 and stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, we were just told, you know, I mean, I'm talking even, you know, the officers like Ben Rogers. I mean, you know, we knew we were going into a village. We knew what it was as far as its level on the HESS system and, you know, what was expected of us. And, you know, we could tell right away what kind of, you know, what kind of village you were walking into. I remember with the first calf going into a Montagnard village one day, and we were right up front with the point guys in the point platoon, and I had another interpreter at the time, and I can't think of his name, and this young kid came running out, and, like running zigzag towards us, and saying, "Dung Lai, Dung Lai G.I., Dung Lai G.I." And so we immediately froze, and everybody, you know, jumped left, jumped right into undercover. This kid came down, and he started talking to the interpreter, like, real fast. And, of course, the Montagnard dialect was a little bit different, and he was having a little trouble understanding it. But the place was loaded with booby traps. Was loaded with booby traps. And they hated the North Vietnamese. The interesting thing was they didn't really care about the South Vietnamese either. But they did like the Americans. So we went into that ville, and we secured it for, like, 24, 36 hours. And we left, and within 24 hours, that village was totally wiped out by the NVA. And I have a picture of me holding a baby in that village. And, you know, I mean, when we went back in the next day, or the day after it happened, when we went out, it's kind of a mixed, as far as days, I can't really tell you. It was shortly thereafter. I mean, it was still smoldering of the huts and things like that.
Oh,
it was, you couldn't tell a dead pig from a dead baby.
Oh, my God.
You know. And that, you know, I mean, I remember looking for the baby and then realizing there was nothing I could do. You know. And then we left a platoon to secure, because there were some survivors, and get them out. And then we, you know, we kind of went off after what we hoped were the remnants of the NVA. We never found anything on that particular day. You know, they were, and we knew they had taken some people with them. And we did find some, you know, some obvious evidence of disembowelment, rape, stuff like that.
Now, were you able to ever integrate those problems, the terrorist acts on the part of the Viet Cong or the NVA, in propaganda that was distributed?
Yeah, you did. But you had to be real careful there because, you know, what they would do is they would turn around, and remember, they had their own, even though it was very, I'm trying to think of the proper word, it was, you know, they didn't have the technology that we had, but they, you know, they would counteract with their own leaflets, some of them hand-drawn, you know, that we were the aggressors. We were going to rape the women and children. So you had to be real careful and touchy with that, because that's a real sanctity among the Vietnamese culture. You know, I mean, the women are obviously, at that point, we're a lower class, but this rage and disembowelment and things like that, we would more or less talk to the villages about that than actually do that to the enemy. You know, and some of that would be vivid descriptions. When you'd be sitting down talking, let's say, with a village chief and and the elders of the village, and saying, "Listen, we were just in, you know, this other hamlet, which is part of your area. You know, they we found evidence where they had kidnapped the village chief's wife and you know, raped her, and you know, a lot of that was being done by the Viet Cong. And of course, they weren't much of an item after Tet 68, but I think that's been overblown. I think they were, I mean, I know they were still in vast numbers. They were just dispersed. They weren't as unified as they should be. And they, of course, at that point, they were acting a lot as intelligence people for, you know, for the North Vietnamese and, you know, different positions. But we would use their atrocities and their wrongdoings for the populace. More so than actually broadcasting to the BC or the NBA.
Now, your interpreter, was he a Hoi Chan, one of the people who took advantage of the Chu Hoi program?
No, no. The two that I work with, the one that I work with mostly, Khan, who actually Ben Rogers corresponded with him for a while after Ben DeRoast. He was from Saigon. I believe he was a Catholic, and he was South Vietnamese. and as were my other interpreters or interpreter that I worked with the first cab with. But we did use the Chuhoys. I've got some pictures of myself in a village with a three-quarter ton with the speaker mounted on the hood of a three-quarter ton truck, and the Hoichans actually and Chuhoys actually walking in front of me, kind of like human minesweepers, if you will. It was, I remember it being a dangerous village, and you know, they were armed. They had their M16s, and they were passing out leaflets and talking to the people, and you know, telling them that they were North Vietnamese, former North Vietnamese soldiers, that they had turned themselves over. And you had to trust them. I mean, the picture tells a thousand words again. I don't mean to repeat myself, but, you know, I'm in there driving this truck, the white T-shirt on, you know, no armor, no helmet on. It's extremely hot. I've got my 16 probably across my lap or right next to me in the door. But my hands, my life is basically in these guys' hands. There's no other American in the picture. It was, you know, sometimes it'd be a very lonely, you know, feeling.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be maybe two or three Americans and four, five, six Hoichans, and your interpreter. And, you know, you're in a village with, you know, anywhere from, you know, 70 to maybe 200 people, you know, women and children, and, you know, always old men. And if the fighting age man wasn't in the South Vietnamese army, then obviously you knew where he was. And you could usually sense it by the, you know, the interrogations and of the people that you talked to, the women, you know. If their husband was a South Vietnamese soldier, a worker of the South Vietnamese government, they would, you know, automatically show you his papers or his photos and things like that. When it was reversed, they were very reclusive and ashamed, frightened that you were going to, you know, because they had been told that, you know, if they were found out that we would, you know, rape the women and we would, you know, kidnap the babies and kill them and destroy the whole village and things like that. So, you know, the propaganda was, you were countering this all the time, and it was very ad-libbed. It was, each village could be totally different. Mm-hmm. Each individual could be totally different.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever encounter villages that were particularly hostile to you and to the people you had with you, whether it be the interpreters or other people, that you know, it was obvious you better get out of there?
Yes. On several occasions, especially, you know, near the Cambodian border, in the Michelin plantation area, you know, they had just been, these people have been at war since whenever, you know, for generations. So we were just one more part of the equation. And they, you know, they didn't trust anybody. They didn't trust the South Vietnamese. They were probably very, in many cases, they were pro Ho Chi Minh. You know, he was their George Washington, and people still today don't get it. You know, he wrote his constitution from our constitution. People forget about these small little, you know, they think they're small, but they're very important facts of history.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an icon. He got rid of the French. He got rid of imperialism. I think his mistake was that, and there was mistakes by us, is that we didn't continue to support him after World War II, so he went to, you know, another source. His first choice was not communism. You know, he wanted a democratic state. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we weren't there to support him. We you know, we supported the French, and we all know what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, several villages you'd go into, and you knew that one, there was no, again, this is repetitious, but there was no young men,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the women would just be absolutely shaking, especially when you had a lot of South Vietnamese with you, because
mm-hmm.
they feared the South Vietnamese extremely much, and they could be very, very cruel to their own people, and we would have to counteract that a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of near showdowns between our forces and the South Vietnamese forces, where, you know, they wouldn't want to take Hoichans. They wouldn't want to take Chuhoys.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one South Vietnamese, either captain or major, we had talked three or four out, including an officer in the North Vietnamese Army, and they were all wounded. And this guy, the major, who we found out later, had been bleeding from the ears from an airstrike. And they were coming out. We saw them. They were within probably 50 meters. I saw their faces. And I heard a command in South Vietnamese. and I'm trying to think of the word, crocodile, has something to do with killing, meaning killing. And I heard a, you know, an M60 open up, and all four of them were cut down. And I was pissed. You know, I talked him out. I wasn't looking mm-hmm. for a ribbon. I wasn't looking for an award. That was my job.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so close, you know. And I remember this son of a bitch just smiling at me, you know. And he said to, I can't think of the first cab, it was a lieutenant who was standing beside me, and he was absolutely livid, too, because he could care less about the Chuhoy
mm-hmm.
or the Chuhoy program, but he wanted the intelligence. And he knew I could provide that.
Right.
You know, and this particular guy, I want to say he was from West Virginia. That's like a flash out of the past. I can kind of remember his face and, you know, them getting in this, like, incredible verbal confrontation. And then all of a sudden you're watching, and it's like slow motion. And the South Vietnamese are all of a sudden kind of leveling their weapons at us, and we're kind of leveling their weapons at them. And, you know, it would have just taken, I believe... And it never happened with me, but I believe, and this happened on many, not many occasions, probably five or six, where just one spark, and we would have been in doing a little rock and roll with our allies.
Had you witnessed that, anything like that yourself, or did you hear stories about it?
I never heard about an actual firefight between the South Vietnamese and the Americans, but I was in probably four, five, six situations, actually one in Benoit,
mm-hmm.
right at the front gate. Where I believe it was some of the military police or some of the South Vietnamese Army confronted us about something about a woman, you know. But it was just hate. You could just feel a hate. And, you know, they wanted us. I always felt they wanted our money. They wanted our supplies. But they could care less about us. And the brutality that they did on their own people. On both sides of the fence, what, you know, the North Vietnamese did, you know, like in the Battle of Hue. Now, I was not there, but, you know, the stories
mm-hmm.
have surfaced over the years of the massacre of Hue,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it far outnumbers the massacre at My Lai, but, of course, the American media has a wonderful, you know, way of doing things the way they want to do.
Right.
And that's another story from the time. That's, you know, that wasn't my time. Yeah, it still bothers me terribly.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it never shows, it's not good copy, that the Americans, you know, gave soccer balls and did work in orphanages. This guy, Jim Dickman, that was my team leader at one time, who committed suicide after we found him in the early 90s. We have an idea why he committed suicide, but he was one hell of a field team leader. And, you know, we ended up working. In fact, he was on the team with Ben Rogers at Camp Red Ball. That's another memory that comes sliding back, and we did some work for the SOS Society of the World. Had a wonderful orphanage just outside of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and I've got some nice pictures of that, you know, me with the orphans. And,
mm-hmm.
And one particular young little kid had his father was awarded the Vietnamese equivalent of our Medal of Honor
mm-hmm.
for bravery, and I've got a picture of that little kid with my bush cap. Hold one, Steve, please.
Sure. Okay. You mentioned acts of cruelty by the Arvin. If you witnessed something like that, or if you heard that something
yes, I did witness that.
Okay, when that happened, did the PSYOPs personnel like yourself? Did you actively engage in some kind of activity to try to minimize the psychological damage? Not psychological in a psychiatric health sense, but psychological and trying to maintain support from a population.
Yes.
Did you guys try to minimize that in any way?
Well, we all try to defuse the situation immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Their interrogators, especially if they had lost somebody that was very, very popular with them, let's say a good company commander or a popular sergeant or someone like that, who had been killed in a firefight. I mean, they were very, very angry. They were very, very bitter. You know, as the Americans were, but I think we just had a better. I think we hold life in dearer than a lot of other nations, for lack of a better term. I don't think the Orientals, and this is not meant to be discriminatory, but I don't think that they have the love of life that we do, and the respect for life that we have. and I refer to like the kamikaze pilots and the bonsai mentality of the Japanese during World War II as a populace, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong were like this. I mean, they very very suicidal sometimes in their frontal attacks on some of our LZs and some of our ambushes, where we were, you know, overwhelmingly just wiping them out. I mean, there are battles where there was, you know, 700, 800, 900 dead, confirmed. I'm sure a lot of those were exaggerated. I mean, I was involved in a couple of, you know, real heavy hitting situations. And then you see the South Vietnamese and even the ROKs absolutely refuse to take prisoners, beat unmercifully suspected or actual, you know, North Vietnamese captives, you know, tie their hands behind their back, maybe strap some barbed wire around their, you know, their upper arms, their biceps, water torture. And sometimes you have to stand back because, you know, I was a lowly E5 or E4 at the time. And it went against everything I believed in. And then when you would see, you know, let's say an American officer step in, you know, I would have to step right in and try to help defuse the situation and then try to, let's say with an NVA prisoner who had been, you know, abused very badly for a very short period of time and try to reassure him that this wasn't going to happen again and that we were going to treat him right and that he was now under American control and things like that. And yet you would accomplish that. And then you had to deal with, in the village, where they would threaten women with 45s with M16s. They would threaten the old men. They would take a kid and threaten a kid, trying to get you know, information out of these families. And a lot of times, these families had no information at all. They would scream and beg, and enough was enough, you know. But a lot of times, sadly, you know, we were told, mind our own business.
Who would tell you that? Who would tell you mind your own business?
The American people, the American officers. And a lot of times they would, you know, after a, sometimes it wouldn't even have to be a large engagement. You know, you'd get a helicopter come in with a province chief or assistant province chief and his American advisor. And they would basically tell you, you know, okay, we're going to take over from here. And, you know, move on. Thanks for a good job, fellas. So you didn't know what happened to the guys that you talked out.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know what happened to the people that, you know, you tried to help.
Mm-hmm.
We know some of the stories today, and they're not pleasant memories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that a lot of the Chuhoys that I talked out, or helped talk out, or, you know, surrendered because of some of the leaflets we dropped. And I don't really take a lot of personal credit. I just did my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were probably executed in some of the POW camps, or, you know, just led miserable lives,
mm-hmm.
And God knows what happened to them. You know, right, wrong, or indifferent, they were still human beings.
Right.
And I'm speaking as an individual now.
Right. You mentioned water torture. What do you mean by that?
They would, you know, especially out in the outer villages, they would have huge vats,
mm-hmm.
Of clay, a big, huge clay vat that would be filled with water for
mm-hmm.
drinking or for bathing or what have you. And they might have to go to the river to get this water, and, you know, or, you know, use a runoff from rain. Of course, they're very, the ingenuity of the Vietnamese, both north and south, was incredible. The way they could make use of, you know, everything around them, anything that was left over. And they would actually take these, you know, North Vietnamese or Viet Cong suspects and hold them upside down and, you know, just hang them in the water, and pull them out of the water and scream and yell at them. And, you know, the guys would they'd be vomiting and their bowels would be letting go. And they had them stripped down to basically just their underwear, if you can call them underwear. And the screaming and yelling, I will never forget. And, again, you know, sometimes you just had to turn your back. You know, as an E5, I didn't have a lot of authority when you had, you know, maybe a captain there or a lieutenant there. His counterpart was doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, there were Americans who did it, too. And you had to stand back or turn your back or walk away.
What was, did you receive any kind of training on interrogation techniques?
No. No. No, other than basically being cordial, mm-hmm. friendly, mm-hmm. Tell them anything they wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. A lot of my counterparts went to the military intelligence school. I believe it was in Indiana. Mm-hmm. Not sure of that. I remember a lot of them came over with, I think it was a 96-something MOS. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong there, Steve. But they were more in the interrogation field. They were more up to date. So we had to kind of, like, you know, ad-lib it. Mm-hmm. But I remember you got more with, you know, more with honey than you did with vinegar.
Mm-hmm. What you mentioned that the Korean, you briefly mentioned the Korean troops in there with their reputation for not taking prisoners. Did you ever work in very close proximity to Koreans?
Just once, mm-hmm. just once, and I want to say it was the Tiger Division. It was near the border of 2 Corps and 3 Corps, just on a big combined operation. And again, there was, you know, some North Vietnamese who wanted to surrender and. You know, they were just gunned down,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the Koreans were—they were a real tough bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, their motto was these—not motto, but their thinking was these were communists. And of course, they had such a vivid hate for the communists because of North Korea and, you know, the Korean War. And I worked with them for how. I want to say like 2.5 days on this particular operation, and most of the operation was in the air for me. I was on the ground about 7 or 8 hours, but, you know, again, I did witness, you know, obviously what I would consider an atrocity.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Yeah, it was another, you know, 4 or 5 that were coming out, and they were coming out, they were just mowed down,
mm-hmm.
and they were just, you know, just left there to rot, you know. That was their psychological warfare, I suppose.
Okay. Did you work with in close proximity or with other country forces, Thais, Australians, New Zealanders, anybody else?
No, worked once with an Australian unit after Tet of 69, but it was the only Australians I really got to meet was an Australian medical unit, civilian unit next to our headquarters down in Benoit. That was our compound, then CIA compound. It was actually supposed to be an MI compound. We found out later it was CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the building that held, mm-hmm. both enlisted and NCO club, and then there was a big wall, and then there was the Australian compound.
Mm-hmm.
And very little contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
Very little contact with them. I know right after Tet of 69, before I went back out in the field, I had to kill one of their monkeys because the thing was rabid and had gotten loose outside of the compound. We found it, and it was on top of a, you know, one of the little village, the little huts, and
mm-hmm.
we threw some fruit to it, and I had to blow it away with my 16.
Mm.
And that's something that's, you know, bothers me today. It was just an innocent animal,
right.
Good-sized spider monkey, but, and I remember there was, and I forget, but it was a guy that showed up at my door the summer of 1970, Pete Deroff. I'd never seen him since. And he was up on the roof getting ready to go home, and he was sunbathing, and he heard the bullet go over, because obviously I was aiming in the other direction, but it must have got deflected from the bones of the monkey or what have you. And I remember him going, you know, Jesus, I'm going home in 2 days, you know, he almost killed me. And then I never saw him after that, and in 1970 he showed up at my front door, you know, long hair, and, you know, we partied together for a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Cindy was there.
Uh-huh.
I never saw him again.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah. Did you have any other interesting encounters with animals in country?
Saw wild elephants from the air, mm-hmm. twice.
Mm-hmm.
Heard what I thought was the roar of a tiger,
mm-hmm.
At night. Of course, the snakes were always around. Everything from python to the crates. I did have an interesting experience, kind of a funny one. We were back out of the field. There were several of us sitting around the table at the club, you know, having a couple of brews because they didn't bother us. We were out making our reports. We just got clean clothes, clean ammo, and turned our reports in. Then we flew out in, you know, 2 or 3 days. And this one of these guys, and he ended up getting sent home in handcuffs because he had so much unauthorized weaponry located in his room. Probably, you know, wannabe, whatever you'd call him today. But he walked in, he had the snake by the throat, and it was this little, you know, looked like a garter snake. It was a crate. And if you're familiar with a crate,
yes,
it's what you call a half-stepper.
Yes.
And it was 2 or 3 of us had our 45s. And we, you know, we pulled them, and we said, get that thing and put it on the ground. And, you know, 2 or 3 of us, you know, put off about 4 or 5 rounds and killed the sucker.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, and, you know, there's... I forget the CO's name. It might have been Captain Jackson at the time, the first sighting. You know, what happened? The guys from CIA come running out, weapons drawn. And of course, you know, 45 does a job on anything. You can imagine what it did to this little snake.
Mm-hmm.
But better that than have that thing bite us.
Mm-hmm.
Because the information that I had about the crate was that if it bit you, you know, that was, you might as well lay down and die because
yep.
you know, they couldn't get you to a hospital. You know, you had... I saw one cobra over there, and I think the cobra over there, I think there was 2 breeds. The one I saw was described as a spitting cobra,
mm-hmm.
and it was on the way. We were going back to a helicopter after an insertion.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nothing deal. We, you know, we found some old bunkers and stuff like that, and I'm being just glad to get out, and, you know, 2 or 3 guys in front of me, like, stopped, and this thing was up, you know, with its head and everything else, and...
Mm-hmm.
I believe somebody shot it. It was just, you know, just happened real fast. We, you know, and then we just crossed. We were real cautious getting back on the ship and
right.
stuff like that. But,
okay.
You know, spiders, you had, God, what are those other things that can be deadly with the curved tail?
Yeah, scorpions and
scorpions,
stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So you had to be careful of those things,
yeah.
you know. I know one of our guys, field team members, and his last name was O'Neill also, Dennis O'Neill, who has chosen not to join the ranks. We used to call each other cousin, even though we weren't related. He was from Massachusetts also.
Mm-hmm.
He was with the 1st Division, and they were getting incoming during Tet of 69, and he ran into a bunker, and as he ran in, there was a cobra.
Oh, goodness.
In the corner of the bunker.
Did he get bit?
So, no, but he had his choice of, you know, going outside or coming inside.
Right.
And he actually came outside, and a mortar went off close by, and he banged his head on... probably a large piece of wood, you know, holding up the roof,
right.
and he got a purple eye for that, so we kind of gave him a little.
Oh, God.
You know.
Okay. Gotcha. This will end the interview with Jack O'Neill on September 10th.